Julie Alexson and Brandon Scott Barney, thank you. Thank you for being at the Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast. I'm so excited to talk to both of you. I met you through a documentary called They Say It Can't Be Done, and I invited you here because I'm really in awe of what you do, what your organizations do, and the work you're doing in the world, and I'm so honored to have you. Julie Alexson is the Chief Manufacturing Development Center Officer at Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine, and she's going to tell you what that means because she's going to be much better at it. And Brandon Scott Barney is the co-founder and director of research and communications at Primary Ocean. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for the kind words. I'm excited to be here and talk with you today.
Well, I feel like I have double greatness today. So thank you for both for being here. And thank you for what you do. At Compassionate Leader Circle, we shine a light on people that are supporting the planet and other people. And I'm very excited to get into what you do and what your organizations do. So why don't we start there? Julie, why don't you tell us about your organization and your role?
Okay, thank you. Well, Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine was founded in 2004 by Dr. Tony Atala. And his work was really groundbreaking. It was the first laboratory produced organ, a tissue engineered organ with a synthetic scaffold and cells from a patient that was made into a bladder and then implanted into a patient that required that. So, you know, that technology really put the Institute on the map, and there was a lot of other technology as well, but it was founded in 2004, and it's really one of the world's leaders in regenerative medicine because it covers such a broad area of not only the tissue engineered organs, but different types of cell therapy, genetically engineered cells, devices, bioprinting, and then really trying to help solve some of the problems within regenerative medicine and some of the things that are needed to be able to make these organs like bioreactors that are similar to an incubator. So the Institute involves not only the basic research, but then once the basic research is done, it comes to what we're calling the Manufacturing Development Center that I oversee, to be able to translate that or transfer it into clinical trials. So we do development studies that are going to optimize that technology. We're going to help them to go through non-clinical studies. We're going to talk to FDA, and then we will manufacture the product that would be ready for a phase one clinical trial. The big piece is the research and then moving it to the clinic for patients in clinical trials, and then hopefully it would be commercialized, but that's our piece in there. And we get a lot of grants to be able to do so through NIH and a lot of other organizations.
Wonderful. I'm curious, Julie and Brandon, you were both in this documentary. Have you ever met before?
Not in person.
I would love to. Not in
person. I am so intrigued by, you know, all of the work that they're doing in Primary Ocean. So I'm hoping someday
that we could. I'm happy to bring you together today anyway. So Brandon, tell us about Primary Ocean and your role there.
You know, Primary Ocean is a company that is founded by, you know, a group of people who are essentially brothers or are like brothers. My two co-founders, Scotty and Brian Schmidt, are brothers. We met in Venice Beach at a very kind of 1960s-esque beach hostel that Scotty sort of owned, and Brian, when he graduated from college, he moved there, and it was a very unusual community of entrepreneurs and people at a time in California when people still were big, dreaming big dreams. Now everyone's just trying to pay their mortgage, but you know, I think that what really was the common thread was that we were not purely interested in financial remuneration as a kind of a goal of life. You know, you can move to New York, you can move to San Francisco. And most people, when they move to LA, they want to involve themselves in Hollywood, perhaps, or they want to, I'm not sure what they want. They want to sort of enjoy a lifestyle. I think that we were all kind of motivated by, I don't know, the Pacific Ocean, by this sort of idea. The Pacific Ocean really means peace. I mean, it's sort of named after this idea that we could all co-create, like Margaret Mead said, a small group of people could change the world. We got really, really lucky in many different respects. So, you know, long after we met, initially, we started Primary Ocean. But I only start with the beginning, that we really met just as friends, just enjoying, you know, life in California and trying to discover how we could solve problems or which problems we should solve. Later on, I had started a media company. It's a public radio company. We produce media about the future of science and technology mainly. And Brian had an events company, and he was sort of transitioning from throwing snow globe and these really large music festivals. He went to a monastery in China and decided he was going to try to change his life and recommit himself to the values of his youth, essentially. And he came back and he said, you know, I think seaweed is my future. And I said, you know, maybe we should research this. We had read all kinds of articles, and Brian astonished me when he was buying science newspapers. You know, he was forwarding me like a science article, literally science, you know, or nature. And he's like, I bought this one for $30 or $40. Do you think I should buy this one? And I had never met in my entire life anyone who had ever paid like cash money on their credit card for scientific paper. So I was completely astonished. Like,
know, love it.
I was like, I can't even believe it. So I was like, don't worry. Let me help you out here. You know, I have like an inside track into science, essentially. I love scientists. I'll show you this secret. There's an email address on the scientific paper. No one will ever email them. We'll email everyone, you know, one in a few will give us calls or whatever. So we started an investigation really together. And what ended up happening is we ended up acquiring the seaweed rights offshore at the first offshore aquaculture farm in the U.S. We met a gentleman on a boat. His name was Phil Kruger. And he essentially said, you guys are not ordinary people. What do you want? And they're like, well, we've really been fascinated by seaweed. He had a mussel farm, and we turned into an agreement where we would pursue seaweed like brothers, though, alongside them, or like sisters, as they pursued mussels. And these two species were symbiotic, and they are symbiotic. And so that was the nature of our collaboration. We raised money to acquire those assets, and then we got really lucky because this international group of seaweed researchers basically won a grant from the U.S. government's ARPA-E program, which is essentially the same agency that created the internet, and they wanted to do this huge disruptive seaweed project with us in California. And we are the market and the sort of commercialization, the stakeholder, the social license component. And they are the seaweed geniuses from Chile and the Faroe Islands, the Netherlands, you know, the rock stars of the seaweed world. And so now we are doing this project. And so what our role has been to identify markets and to focus on the commercial side of things. So we have a factory and we have another factory and we produce various products. And the research side is to find a way to farm so much seaweed to the Pacific Ocean that we could save the world and save everything.
I want to tie these two things together. So regenerative health and preventing, you know, illness through innovation, and also helping us, you know, feed the world are really big ideas and important ideas. And I do recommend the movie, They Say It Can't Be Done, because it really gave me a lot of hope about our future and kind of caught me up with things that I thought were science fiction are not really science fiction. They're happening right now. But Julie, I'm interested in you, like, how did you land in this field? What's your background?
Yeah, so it was a jagged path, you know? So I guess I kind of started in business when I started out in school, but had a really close friend that was in medical school. And that's really where I got interested in science. So my bachelor's and master's degree were in medical laboratory science because I thought I was going to do laboratory testing. And when I finished that, I was teaching blood banker immunohematology, as well as I immediately got involved in a new bone marrow transplant program. So the University of Miami was working on getting a certificate of need, and they're putting together a team to be able to set up the program. And so I volunteered. I usually volunteer for everything, probably too much. And that really, you know, kind of solidified, you know, what I wanted to do, being at the bedside of the patient, because we all set up the program together. We did all the steps together at the laboratory that I ran. We made the product, and I actually had a, if you all remember the little carts you had for your luggage, maybe Brandon doesn't remember that. You probably don't. I had to take that across the street in downtown Miami to get the product to the patient. And we would, you know, we're all around there. And then the director's like, okay, who hooks up? Who does this? I don't think that's me, because I have a master's degree. But, you know, everybody was trying to do their best with the patient. So I was at the bedside of the patient, and just seeing that, and seeing the patients get better. And then I was involved with Miami Children's Hospital and seeing the kids and being right at the bedside, it really made an effect on me. And I think, you know, it was lifelong that I really wanted to be able to help. Whatever my small portion was, that makes me feel good. And it makes me feel like I'm doing something important and helping people. So I guess that's really what got me started. And then later on, I got my PhD. And so I've always been running a lab, started out in cell therapy. And then when I moved to Wake Forest, it's really when I got into the tissue engineering and so forth. But so it's been 30 years in the field, but I've learned a lot, and I've had a lot of great mentors. So, you know, as you have a path that might be very different or challenging, if you have a good mentor, that is the most important thing in the world. And I can't thank those people enough for helping me. And I think that's important. When you're a leader, you talk about compassionate leading. You need to make the people underneath you successful and figure out how to help them. And that's the situation I was in. So I would give all those people a lot of credit as well.
I came up with a new definition for leadership today. Would you like to hear it?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I used to believe that leadership was inspiring and influencing other people, but now I'm saying that it's inspiring and influencing other people so they can inspire and influence other people. So we have a model around all of us. Everyone is a leader, especially with the world being so flat and everyone having access to social media and influence, whether you're in high school or whether you're, you know, PhD at a university. I think we're all leaders, and we need a definition for leadership. So Brandon, thank you. Brandon, let's come back to you. So my biggest question is, my biggest curiosity, because I'm a foodie, is where are we currently eating kelp? Like, where, in what products do we, you know, eat kelp? And where do you see it going, like, in the future?
Well, I would say that, you know, giant kelp is the foundation of the most productive ecosystem in the world, more productive than a rainforest, the giant kelp forest off California. And it's sort of hidden, because have you had abalone or uni?
Yes.
And these two are two very premium kind of seafood products. These creatures only eat giant kelp mixed in with some other seeds. So we have a friend who, his name is Doug, and he owns the cultured abalone. He goes out and gets the giant kelp, and he feeds it to the abalone. And it takes, you know, 3 years, it takes 4 years, it takes 5 years. But if you go on his website, you can spend a lot of money, you know, actually buying the biggest, most beautiful abalone you've ever seen in the world, the size of your hand probably, or larger, with the most exquisite shell. And if you research them, they eat giant kelp. And so that's one form where people do eat giant kelp. It's kind of, it's a bit removed from the average person's diet in America, but giant kelp can also be found in its other forms, its extracts, particularly alginate, in almost everything. Like, for example, the beer foam that you might enjoy when you take a sip of a beer. you go on YouTube, you can see when you make beer with or without algae date what it looks like. The foaming effect is totally different. The same is true for ice cream. So if you get a cookbook and you want to make your own ice cream, your own kind of homemade ice cream, you would need certain hydrocolloids like alginate. So in fact, alginate is actually, or giant kelp is actually in almost everything that you would eat, especially if it's a baked good or certain types of desserts or beverages. It's just an ingredient. And so whether you eat it in its sort of raw form, which some people do as a very high-end kind of California health supplement, where you can take a shot of, you know, spirulina, you can buy it at Erewhon or Whole Foods and, you know, get your day started off right.
Is spirulina kelp? I never knew that.
Yeah.
No. Those are two different species. They're both in the same, you know, they're both algae. There are entrepreneurs who do sell, you know, a seaweed shot, so a macroalgae shot versus a microalgae shot. So basically, in the early life stage of the big seaweed that you see on the beach, it is the little spirulina-sized seaweed or algae. But giant kelp is actually, surprisingly, you know, in potato chips, you have kelp salt, where they'll dry it, and then, you know, you can have potato chips that have a kind of a natural salt substitute. So it's kind of a, you know, you'd be surprised, actually. I could sell you as much giant kelp food products as you'd like.
Well, I'm currently on a raw juice fast, but I'm going to go eat some ice cream tomorrow because it has kelp in it.
Hey.
Go ahead.
I can put it in my green juice.
Go ahead, Brandon.
Have you ever heard of the company La Mer? You know the concentrate for La Mer, it's an Estee Lauder brand, but it's the most expensive cosmetic product in the world. It's $400 an ounce. I could send you a link to their website. And it's giant kelp, hand-harvested off British Columbia, which is then cold vacuum pressed and then fermented for 3 days. And then it's said to be one of the most effective concentrated beauty products in the world and priced accordingly. It's in the, if you ever get your dental impressions done, the alginate, that's also giant kelp. I could go up.
I know you're harvesting it, but I was wondering like where it goes after that, you know?
Well, you know, there's in the natural ecosystem, the giant kelp is a part of the food web. Now, within Southern California, if anything lands on the beach between Malibu and, you know, I don't even know, basically San Diego, someone's going to basically take that to a landfill, or that it may be composted and sent to an organic diversion facility. And what we do is we sustainably harvest and we process giant kelp. We seek to, you know, follow the Iroquois sort of principle to leave no waste. But it's worth so much that it'd be crazy to waste anything, actually. I mean, it's such a magical, powerful resource, actually. Like, for example, when I saw the Wake Forest presentation, it made me wonder about our alginate sort of scaffolding. We have R&D for, like, bio-scaffolding. Now, of course, it's not in our current business plan this calendar year to pursue that. It's like, you know, 10 years from now and 20 years from now. But listening to some of the FDA challenges and some of the issues and researching it, we found that, I'll tell you, we follow nature. And so the fact that giant kelp is said to be such a productive ecosystem person, I'm like, I'm with it. We believe it. And that's what we found.
That's amazing. So maybe 10 years from now, we'll have Julie and you back and you'll be providing nutrients for what she does. But let's go back to Julie. Julie, tell me exactly what happens in a lab that you're helping run, because it's fascinating. And I just, you know, sort of in layman terms, like what are you doing in there?
Yes. I mean, people have a hard time understanding, because the first step is going to be to work with the PI or the PhD that has his research or her research that has provided proof of concept. So they were able to prove that it works in a smaller fashion. And then we are going to optimize that and scale it up. So that section is called process development. And everybody says, you know, what are you doing in process development? So they've done some what's called non-clinical studies. And we're going to look at those cells to make sure that when we collect them, that they get to us and they're viable. So we're going to look at stability of the product coming in and the product going out. We're going to look at the identity of the product. So what are the cells that we're getting? Are we isolating some of those and expanding them? And how fast are they growing? Are they producing cytokines or some type of growth factor, something that comes from the cell that might be important for the therapy? So that's called characterization. We're also looking at what is the container it's going to go in as we transfer it to the facility where it's going to be used. That's whether it's going to be implanted or if it's a cell therapy product that's going to be provided IV intravenous into the blood. So there's a lot of steps that take place. And then they also will make that product several times, which is called the engineering runs, to make sure that it's done acceptable, it passes the requirements, it's safe. You do sterility testing to make sure that nothing's growing in it, that everything's safe for the patient, and then it gets transferred to our manufacturing facility. In the manufacturing facility, they're gonna go through some of those same engineering runs, but in their hands, they're in a very clean room. So we have to make sure that particle counts, it's very low. They're working also in a laminar flow hood, which is also clean, and usually the system is closed down. So we want to make sure that nothing enters into that system where we're making the product. So they'll go through runs, and then they actually qualify that product through different types of tests. And we have a whole QC, what's called quality control department, that runs all of those tests. Throughout all those steps, the quality assurance folks are checking off to make sure everything's done right, because quality assurance has to sign on the bottom line to say this product is good to go over to the hospital to be implanted into a patient. Throughout that whole process, we're talking to FDA. We're talking to them in the beginning to say, are these the right studies we should do? Is this the right one study that we should do, the definitive study, to take us into phase one clinical trials? And then we submit what's called an IND or an investigational drug application to find out if they'd let us go into phase one clinical trials. So FDA is super important, and we have a very close relationship so that they answer a lot of questions for us. So it is kind of hard to give you everything, but there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. And honestly, people in translation don't even understand everything in process.
But I'm
going
to take a stab for my listeners, because it sounds very complicated. But what I think Julie is saying is she and her team are, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Julie, are using cells from patients to generate organs that can be implanted back into the patient. It's actually grown in a laboratory and has a less likelihood of rejection because it's actually made from cells from the patient.
Yes.
This is amazing. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's good.
I feel like I got an A in the high points. I feel like I got an A in science class today. And tell us what organs have been successfully transplanted so far, and what do you see for the future?
Yeah. So, you know, some of them that have been implanted and went all the way to phase two was the tissue engineered bladder. And we're actually looking at different clinical indications for that. Tissue engineered urethra, where there were patients, accident victims, that was already implanted. And we actually have a phase one study ongoing right now at Wake Forest. We have started tissue engineered corpora. These things are for the wounded warriors. So blast injuries that we've been working on for a long time, supported through Department of Defense. And these are just now going into clinical trials. They've been approved. So this would be the first patients that would be treated with that. But we've also
treated patients with what's called stress urinary incontinence when they're leaking with their own muscle progenitor cells. And we're also working on a study with an acellular product, which is very interesting. It comes from the placenta. It's around the placenta, the amniotic membrane that's used for wound healing. So all of that normally would get discarded after the birth. And so, you know, it's a really important source. There's a lot of different cells. We work on cells from the organ as well that otherwise would go to the waste. So it's really fascinating.
It's amazing. And the potential for the future is amazing. So Brandon, I looked on your website today. You're doing a lot more than just harvesting kelp. Can you tell us a little more about what you're up to at Primary Ocean?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, we really spend a lot of our time trying to experience compassion more deeply instead of viciously, because that's what the market is really. We're trying to listen to the market, listen to what people want, what they actually need. And that's very important. So, for example, you know, we spend a lot of our time just reading research and also studying social problems. So, for example, I was really excited to study or to read that it might be possible to develop non-hormonal forms of birth control using alginate beads. And I just so happened to attend some book event for a friend of mine who has a period menstrual advocacy group. She's trying to have compassion for people who have menstruation. But I was able to experience that. And then when I was reviewing my paper library, as I'm off to do, something jumped out at me more than would otherwise have jumped out at me. That actually is a very large potential market. So in our work, we spend a lot of time in part connecting the dots between what has been researched and what people need and want, and trying to think about the pathway, you know, those pathways between those two things and the time that it might take. And now in our current work, however, we're deeply focused in regenerative agriculture. When we started our investigation, we were really interested in the methane mitigating effects of the certain species of seedweed as affecting livestock. And then we went out to 100 farmers in California and in Texas and Oklahoma and all across America. And they all told us, we don't really care about that. That's really important, but we are running out of water. So next year, I'm not going to have enough water, so I'm going to have to sell this. So by the time California mandates the methane, I'll be out of business anyway. And so because we listened and we felt that the seriousness of what they said, we moved it to seaweed, giant kelp, as it pertains to water efficiency and rooting and soil moisture and all these different things. And so now we are financing crop trials all across the country and have commercial trials and partners all around the world, really, trying to see how can we take what nature has done, which is this 3 feet a day, amazing yield organically and naturally. How can we learn from that and translate that into what a strawberry grower will experience in Ventura? And we're happy that that's what we've been doing. So I didn't mention that you can consume our product, you know, in grocery stores. If you eat strawberries or wonderful nuts, or many of our products are now serving farmers, and they're entering into people's palates by way of healthier, more nutritious food, the food that is there in the midst of what is a really catastrophic drought. So we spend a lot of time in the agriculture space, talking to farmers, conducting. I learned about science, actually, and the difficulty that it truly, when we started doing agricultural research, because it's sort of like, okay, you're going to pay all these people, they're going to do this careful planting in all these different regions, and then we're going to wait and count everything. And now we have to explain, why are these different? You know, why can't it be replicated? It's very interesting. But aside from that, we think about new product categories, like, you know, in the health space, there are lots of like seaweed that you can consume that will improve your immune response. And so in the COVID crisis, we were really interested in certain things. We may be introducing products like that. Alginate face masks are really popular in the cosmetics industry, and it would take less time for us to produce that than it would for us to make an alginate scaffolding and work with Lake Forest, and the money from that might support the latter. So we try to solve problems, but we have to also try to make money, and we try to balance these different things, the timing of everything. And that's really this game that we're playing, where we're looking at different markets, We have our core products in agriculture, but we're trying to listen and feel really compassionately to what other things does the world want and need, and then prioritize our product portfolio and pipeline, things that we thought were important a year ago before COVID. You know, we have to change, we have to be flexible. And so that's an ongoing kind of two-step that we're doing.
So I appreciate everything you're doing. So did you say that kelp grows 3 feet a day?
Under ideal conditions, according to some scientific papers, which I'm happy to provide you. Now, kelp, I like to say, is nature's self-replicating solar panel. It floats in the ocean. You like that? You like that, right? The first paper on giant kelp island was published in the Journal of Solar Engineering in the 1970s, when the Navy and GE and the American government first funded efforts in this regard. But it's because it grows so quickly, it made them think that this was the real ethanol crop in the 70s. What ended up happening is it didn't really work out, mainly, I think, because the offshore oil industry had not developed enough so that we can borrow a lot of their people who want to now save the world, who are very brilliant and know how to build things and manage things in the ocean. So I think there was a technology gap when it was tried the first time, but it is an old story predicated on this amazing productivity where the seals and the dolphins and all these creatures, the abalone and the scallops and the clams and the rocks, they're said that the foundation of all of that is the giant kelp. So and that actually bears fruit. If you do a radio isotope analysis of the food chain of the kelp forest, you do see this sort of pattern. It's not as simple as the original biological description, but it still is very exciting. I mean, in general, I think that there's a lot that we can learn from.
Amazing. I'm curious, Brandon, you first, were you interested in science as a teenager? What were you doing when you were 14?
I would be ashamed to deny the truth, which is that I was the captain of the science club, academic decathlon, the whole game. You know, I was in it to win it from a very early age. I read the encyclopedia, the dictionary. I tell people the library card, you know, you can take it all the way. But I took it very, very seriously. I mean, that I ultimately made it possible for me to do what I'm doing now. I'm so grateful for the librarians. I always shout out, I think the teachers are important, the professors are important, but the librarians, the research assistants, the people who can help you with questions that other people really can't help you with. No one can help you with that question. But I had a lot of questions that no one wanted to help me with. So when I was 14, I was in the library. I was also building computers, downloading everything off the internet in case society ended. You know, I mean, I was a pretty strange kid, actually. But I was really inspired by Benjamin Franklin.
Fantastic. And Julie, what were you doing when you were 14?
Okay, he's hard to follow because I was athletic, you know, and I still had that interest in business before I really got interested in science. So I was on the softball team and soccer team and cheerleading, and I just loved to be active. So although I did love like school, it wasn't, and I was good in science, but it wasn't that I was thinking, oh, I'm going to be a scientist, or, you know, not until I got a little bit older. Then I was super excited about, you know, I wanted to go to medical school at one point, you know, watching the hemoncs and during the transplant, but then, you know, I really did enjoy leading the facilities that made the products and tested them. And that's really where I decided to get my PhD. But
it's never too late, because when I was 14, I have an undergrad in hotel management and a master's in organizational psychology. But the older I get, the more interested I am in science. And my dad was an engineer at IBM who tested Apollo program computers. So when we watched the moon landing, my father had worked on computers that were in that apparatus. But I had no interest in it at the time. Thank God my dad is still with us, and I can talk to him about the scientists that I met today and the people that are interested in science. So it's never too late to become a science geek. It can happen in your 50s or when you're a teenager, all different times. But I think the older I get and the more I worry about the future beyond my lifetime, the more interested I am in how are my nieces and nephews going to have a planet? And thank you again and your colleagues for everything you do. So before we close, Brandon, tell us anything else you want to say about Primary Ocean and tell our listeners how they can learn more about your amazing company.
Well, thank you very much for hosting us. I appreciate this opportunity to learn from Julie and you and to experience compassion, you know, and just be reminded of its importance and centrality in everything that we do. People can learn about us online at our website, primaryocean.com. There's the film, They Say It Can't Be Done. It's on Apple and YouTube for rental and purchase. They can also contact me or contact any of us, you know, anytime on social media. So what I would just say is that people can get involved in what we're doing all over the world. They should. As more and more people get involved in what Julie is doing, regenerative medicine, or we're doing regenerative agriculture, then those adjectives will really become the nouns. We'll live in a world like that. And I think that is what we're all looking for. So thank you.
You're welcome. And Julie, same question. Anything else you want to say and tell our listeners how they can learn more?
So you can find us on the website for Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine. And, you know, I want to add that the field, you know, it's slow to move because it really needs support. I sit on a lot of different boards and we try and get people involved and organizations involved to be able to help support the effort because there needs to be a lot of work on the process development to move these products into clinical trials. And FDA requires a lot of clinical trials to be able to get it out to commercialization. So, you know, as we get more mature, we have more and more of the organizations or the companies that are supporting raw materials and the supplies that we need. As Brandon talked about, you know, some of the scaffolding. I mean, these things are all important because without that, we can't do our job, or we're producing that and it's taking a lot longer and costing a lot more. So, I mean, I guess everybody that can get involved or can support the effort for regenerative medicine, we'd be truly honored. It takes a village to be able to move these products forward. I might be up here talking, but there's hundreds and hundreds of people behind what I do and what my boss, Dr. Tala, does. So to thank everybody, but it's a team village effort to be able to move things forward. And thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's an honor to have you, and I'm happy to get the word out about both of your amazing paths. And these emerging industries are going to be so important to sustainability and health and preventive health. And anyway, it was an honor to have you. I feel like I have two new friends. I'm delighted about that. And thank you for coming.
Thank you.